Hello and welcome to Spotlight on Transitional Justice. This is a podcast in which we explore the relevance of transitional justice concepts in today's world, with a special focus on ongoing conflicts and the one in Ukraine. Today's episode will focus on the relationship between media and transitional justice, and what lessons, if any, from various different examples of these efforts being implemented around the world are there for our Ukrainian colleagues. My guest today is also a friend of mine. We have been sharing this space of this relationship between media and transitional justice for many years, I dare say. Thierry Crevalier is one of the most seasoned and respected reporters on issues of transitional justice, with experience spanning countries from Rwanda to Sierra Leone and Cambodia. He's a co-editor-in-chief of Justice Info, one of the most known global platforms where these issues are illuminated and reported on. Thierry, thank you very much for joining us today and sparing time to talk to us on this important issue.
Hi, Refik. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with going to the substance of the question. In your experience, what would you define, how would you define the relationship between media and transitional justice efforts as a journalist who has reported for so many years on these various different efforts in different countries?
It's a strange relationship in a way. I think that with some level of perhaps of misunderstanding sometimes. Well, first of all, I think it's worth saying that we have to be very humble about the role of the media in general and its influence. I'm not saying that it's not important. Of course it is, but we have to be a bit cautious about how much it can influence, for instance, a transitional justice process. You and I can bring many examples of media coverage that seem to be critical and essential about very crucial issues and that didn't have the impact that one would expect, or certainly not the one that was expected from the publishers. So that would be, and that's not depressing to me. I think it's just a reasonable understanding of what the media is. But then, of course, it's transitional justice. So it's not any kind of field. It's charged with a lot of emotions, of historical and social dimensions. So there is that level of engagement. It's clear that the media covering this is part, well, let's put it this way. Without the media, there is no genuine informed public engagement in transitional justice, in my view. And like, what would be the purpose of a transitional process if it was not public, if it was not covered independently and critically by the media? Let me take two examples. Currently, there is the Kosovo Specialist Chambers that is based in The Hague, trying cases against the former Kosovo Liberation Army. It's extremely hard to cover these trials because most of the time they're in camera, behind closed doors. There's very little access and information about what's going on. And as a result, no real outreach effort either. And who knows what is going on before this court. Who knows what the trials are about? I don't think anyone does. I think that the relevance in that case of that court is immediately diminished because nobody really knows what's going on in The Hague. So that's a good example of, yeah, if there is no media coverage because of, you know, lack of access, for instance, of lack of transparency, then I think the whole process is can be questioned, its relevance can be questioned. I can take a better, a positive example. The Truth Commission in The Gambia was, in my view, in the past few years, was one of the greatest events in transitional justice. Incredible. 2 years of public hearings, spectacular revelations, incredible amount of information that we got from that process about the dictatorship of Jammeh in this West African country. It was an event. It was a national event all the time. Like, people were glued to their social network or TV during that process. Why? Because it was public, because it was very well covered by the local media and by us as well at Justice Info. And I don't think, again, that without that incredible public coverage, the impact and the resonance of the Truth Commission process in The Gambia would have been the same. It's always, it's very logical what I'm saying, right? So, so yes, our role is two things. I think that, you know, I'm a very strong believer in the watchdog role. I think that once you have a justice process, because that's what we're talking about, by the moment a transitional justice process is on, our role becomes crucially to be a watchdog, which is to make sure that the process goes transparently and according to what, you know, what the rules were or what the objective were. So that part to me is essential. And that's where I'm saying that sometimes there is a bit of a misunderstanding between the institutions that run these processes and the media. Like, and you've been in the position, so you know very well, but I, you know, I remember several times with institutions officials, transitional justice institutions officials, saying that the media has to support us. And I was always like, well, with all due respect, no, we're not here to support you. Not really. Because we are not, we don't have the same responsibilities. We are here to cover you, to make sure that what is going on before in this process, in this institution, is known by the public. But we're here to also make sure that you're doing the job, you know, as expected, and with the ethics that come with it. So you see, there's always that sort of a bit of ambiguity about it, because of what is at stake in this process. There is an expectation, and of course, the media remains a social actor, and in that sense, its engagement and its coverage is of course important, and without it, the process becomes irrelevant. But also, we have to remain a watchdog. I believe that very strongly. I think that, and you can see it, when a transitional justice process has no watchdog, it doesn't go well. It doesn't evolve well. It gradually deteriorates. That's what I've seen everywhere.
I want to pick up on this and let's say, dig deeper a little bit about this issue of what the role is, because I think the two examples that you gave are so illustrative of this dilemma in terms of whether the media needs to be regarded as an actor in the process rather than simply an observer. Even an observer with a role of a watchdog, as you well described here, because like you just described, the Kosovo chamber has zero impact on the societal public debate in Kosovo or in Serbia. And that is very interesting because, especially in Serbia, you had, as you know well, for years, various different politicians and other actors saying, what about crimes against the Serbs and so on, you know, the international justice is biased in this respect and blah, blah, blah. Now we have this effort, which is supposed to be looking into this, and nobody there, like you said, even knows that this is going on, let alone is engaged in some sort of discussion. While at the same time, the Gambia example tells you what the impact of transitional justice efforts can be when they are subject to the public debate and catharsis in a way. Now, the role of media is crucial in mediating this public debate, in ensuring that people are aware of what is going on. What is the space to address this in terms of, as I said, in during the design of transitional justice effort, to understand that the impact, not only the impact, but this process of social change that transitional justice is supposed to facilitate or catalyze, is impossible if these processes are going to be conducted so far from the public view?
I think maybe there are two things that come to mind. There is that what we call outreach part and the media. This outreach part, that is, as far as I understand it, is that all, and you know it very well, that all these courts and truth commissions and, you know, essentially these two, let's say, these two kind of transitional justice processes, they are now, we expect them to have an outreach action, which is to really organize something so that the information that comes out of their trials or their public hearings go to the population as much as possible. So you can organize public screenings or, you know, all sorts of actions can be taken. So it's not the media, it's a public, it's a sort of a public information outreach action. On this, the history of institutions is that they're always late at organizing this. It's very rarely designed when the court or when the truth commission is being created, which is where it should be designed. It should be designed from the start. It has rarely been so, but there have been some better examples than others. And usually it's controlled by the institution. There is one exception, and to me it's the best example so far. It's the Habré trial. So the trial of the former Chad dictator before a Senegalese court supported by the African Union, taking place in Senegal. So Senegal was in charge, and amazingly, they organized, they thought about the filming of the trial and the action to make sure that people in Chad would know about what's going on in Dakar about their former dictator. And not only they thought about it from the start and organized the filming in a way that was not controlled by the court, but technically, editorially organized by the Senegalese TV. So professionals were in charge of filming, not technicians controlled by the judges. It makes a huge difference because the quality of the filming was so much better and so much more relevant, full of information than whenever it's controlled by judges and by the court. And on top of it, they delegated the whole outreach program to three NGOs, one from Chad, one from Senegal, one from Belgium, to be in charge. And those guys knew what they were doing. They were professionals, as opposed to, you know, civil servants. I mean, people in charge with perhaps some technical knowledge, but not media people. To me, it provided the best model ever, and no one repeated it. Why? Because you need this institution to agree to lose control, and they don't want to lose control. And that's the sad part of it, in my view, is that there is a global understanding that outreach is essential, and in fact, the best practice of outreach is never copied, repeated as the must-do thing. And as a result, because it could be too long a conversation, but as a result, like the video archive, let's take the video archives of international tribunals. Of course, they were made for history, to serve historical memory and access, and the use of this for the public understanding and for more people to know about these trials, because nothing beats image, video. I'm the first one to know because I'm a writer, and I know that my impact is not the same than someone who shows what I'm writing about. So I perfectly respect that. Well, these video archives, because they've been controlled by the courts, they are poorly filmed. They don't have a good documentary value because they were too restricted, too controlled by people who have no idea of what an image is. How many times have I heard in courts that the filming is objective? Oh, come on. I mean, you know, it's irritating to be in the 2000s and to still listen to the idea of an objective image. It's lesson number one. There is no such thing. So it's that level of understanding that rules the filming. And what is sad to me is that as a result, we don't have video archives exist from all these historical trials, but they're very hard to use. They're difficult to access and they're very truncated. They are not properly designed. If you look at how the Eichmann trial was filmed back in the 60s, it's so much more modern, liberal, and useful. If we have these fabulous movies made out of the footage of the Eichmann trial today that everybody can see and go to cinema to watch, it's because the filming was so good and because the court let it be done by a professional filmmaker. We don't have that today. And I'm still wondering, like, why, how did it go so wrong? How did we miss that rendezvous with public information and a better understanding of why it is so important? So outreach or filming, if I can take these two examples of media-related issues that go to the heart of these processes, let them be done and controlled by professionals. We don't give filmmakers the role to try an individual for war crimes. Why do we give judges, prosecutors the control of an image that they have no idea about? That is, to me, there's a lot that is to be improved, because we actually not nearly as good as they were in the 60s. So it's a bit sad because, of course, we have much better material, but we don't use it well. So that's outreach to me, where there is some good practice that should be always the reference, and it's not. So it's very saddening. And then, of course, there's the role of the media, and I can't remember exactly what you asked in that respect that was different than what I already said.
Let me just build on what you said, because as you know, I've been working for these institutions for a long time, and I absolutely agree. The core of the problem is that many of these legal professionals who make all the decisions in these institutions don't see the public this social change element as anything to do with the mandate of the institution. And this kind of restrictive thinking comes from the fact that they're not comfortable with this. They are used to being protected by the sanctity of the courtroom, and in a way not being subject to public scrutiny in many cases. But let me ask you this, and then we can cross over to a different subject of more journalistic experience. But just to finish this part of the conversation, from your experience, do you know of any examples where the media coverage in fact shaped the public opinion about a certain justice effort to the point where the what happened in these processes, in these courtrooms, in these truth commissions was either misunderstood or not understood by the public due to the media coverage?
It's hard to be totally sure that it was the media responsible for it. That's why I'm always a bit cautious about the impact, because it's very hard to assess. So it's tempting to say yes, like for instance, well, you know, the region you know, many places in the world, but the region you know best because you're from there, the Balkans, Bosnia in particular, or Serbia, you would be tempted to say that the whole way the media covered the justice efforts, be they before the International Tribunal in The Hague or before domestic courts, has led to that situation where denial is still dominant in the region, even though you would think that after 25 years of trials or 30 years of trials, there should be a common understanding of what happened and who was responsible for what. And there doesn't seem to be a common understanding. And so it would be tempting to say, well, that's because the media was polarized and just divisive, and that the coverage of the media created this. But what's the media? I mean, I think the politicians, political actors, played a leading role in that confusion and misunderstanding of the whole process and of the court's decisions. The media reflects that. The media is always a bit of a mirror of your society. If your society is polarized, is divided, your media is. And so I'm always a bit like, where does it start? Because there's been incredible coverage of these trials. There were massive efforts. I mean, the outreach of the court, for instance, came late, but it came rather big. Some NGOs have organized coverage of the trials extensively, comprehensively, for years, and spread information in the region. So you're like, so what could we do better or more than what has been done? It was not a situation to me where there was lack of information. That's why I'm so cautious, Rafik, about the impact of the media, because you can do the work and still do not achieve what you would expect that work to achieve. Now, I think we all journalists who've covered these trials in particular, must have a confused and humble understanding of the impact of their work. In my own work, I can give examples of situations where my coverage on very sensitive, crucial moments in the process helped change it. And I can give you other examples where similarly sensitive, important, crucial reporting did not make any difference. And I could never tell why this one was influential and why this one was not. Meaning, it was not about me. It was not about my reporting. It was other factors, probably political, mostly other, that at that moment used my reporting or helped my reporting to have that kind of influence. And in the other moment where the politics were hostile to that reporting, were not happy with that reporting, they could definitely manage to make it irrelevant or unimpactful. So I don't know if that helps you as an answer, but again, you will never hear from me that reporting, media reporting, can really shape a process. I don't think so. I think that without it, it's a no-brainer that the process will go wrong. That is very clear to me. But with it doesn't mean that it will shape it. What shapes a process is a combination of, I think, different factors. And I think at the end of the day, the political factor remains essential, central to me. If there is a political leadership and political common understanding of what is at stake and what is the objective, then that shapes the process.
We absolutely agree on that. Let me switch over to a related topic. And as I said in the introduction, this podcast is primarily trying to help our colleagues in Ukraine grapple with these issues. And reporting on international crimes, on mass atrocities of this nature, especially in an ongoing conflict, in polarized societies, is an extremely challenging work. Can you tell me, from your experience, what were the ethical challenges that either you yourself faced in reporting on these issues, or you observed local media grapple with during your career?
Well, Ukrainians in that respect, I think, face a particularly challenging situation because their justice effort is going on while the war is raging. And that is not so common, as you know, like most of the justice processes that we have seen, covered, happened after the war or after the dictatorship. Ukrainians started their war crimes trials 3 months into the war, while fighting occupation and invasion. So that is a pretty unusual situation in my view. That made the usual challenges of reporters covering these trials even more acute. So the ethical. That's again another thing. Like, I think the ethics of a journalist covering war crimes trials, because let's take trials alone here, because that's what they have in Ukraine, is essentially the same. It's the same ethics of journalists in general. You know, why would it be different? So you know, it's to be impartial, to be balanced, and to be accurate, for instance, like, you know, three basic rules that anyway you apply whenever you do your reporting on whatever subject. What's a bit different, of course, is that what's at stake is usually an entire society, and what's at stake is major crimes that, you know, have affected thousands, dozens of thousands, or millions. And for the defendants, it's huge too, because they risk being, you know, held responsible for the worst crimes ever, crimes against humanity, you know, or war crimes or genocide. So the stakes are high, but the ethics are the same to me. Now, of course, it's a trial, so there are specific issues. And to me, the two biggest dilemmas key questions that reporters face, and sometimes I'm always afraid because it looks simple, like, and my experience that it's not, so I repeat it. First one is presumption of innocence. I mean, there's a point where it's absolutely central to your work as a reporter, and it's amazing how many reporters forgot what it is and why we're having this. So to me, there's always like a primary effort is to be reminded that what is presumption of innocence and how do we apply it? How do we respect it as reporters? Because we're the front line on this. Like, if our reporting is not respecting that presumption, then how do you expect the public to share that concern and to understand why we must be careful before a court gives a decision? So that to me is always a very specific aspect of it, and that it's always to be reminded to anyone. I'm not making a difference between so-called reporters from the south or from the north. I see exactly the same behavior in any part of the world. So that's one. In some countries, in many situations, not always, but not with the same intensity, the witness protection issue is a big deal for reporters. Like, how do we respect witness protection? How do we apply it in the media? What are we bound to? What is our relationship to court decision when it comes to witness protection? It's complicated. It's not as simple as what people may think, which is to say, well, the media is bound by the decision and they just have to apply it and to be very careful. Yes, of course, that's the basics. Of course, we are ruled by the do no harm red line. So anytime you can assess that you're going to put someone's life in danger in one way or another, you just don't do it. And that's not proper, again, to court reporting. That's just proper to journalism. So that part is simple. The part that is less simple, which is that there might be some situations, and I've been through them, so it's real, where witness protection before international tribunals appear to amount to protecting the interest of the court as opposed to the witnesses. Because there was no such real witness protection, first, technically, they didn't have the means for it, and two, there was not necessarily that witness level of threat. And so there was an abuse of the system of witness protection that led to trials being much less transparent, much less public, etc., etc. And so, just to put it shortly, there were situations where you could be conflicted between the obvious respect for an order of witness protection and your clear concern for the safety of witnesses and public interest. And at some point, there have been a few situations, rare, but there have been a few situations where, in my view, public interest trumped the witness protection order, because that order was not based on the interest of the victims, but on the interest of the court. So anyway, so that's a very specific dilemma that is, to me, the most difficult one. I don't think there is anything more difficult than that balancing act when it happens for a reporter between in assessing what amounts to public interest and what is there a witness protection issue here that is genuine, real, and then there is no discussion, or is it a disguise for protecting another interest, which is the court's interest? And then I'm not bound by it. And then I think that reporters have a duty to, may have a duty to give priority to, primacy to public interest. Anyway, so there are some specific ethical challenges, and to me these are, presumption of innocence is just a constant reminder. I think we have to always remind this. It's key. And witness protection is the most difficult. It's simple in general. It's basic. Like, of course, we do no harm. And there will be situations where it's a very complicated challenge for us.
Ask you a bit more about the do no harm principle. In your opinion, witnesses and victims, especially in circumstances such as Ukraine, where the conflict is still ongoing and journalists are sometimes the first people to reach those who have suffered these atrocities, what are the considerations the journalists have to keep in mind in upholding this principle of do no harm in reporting with victims of such crimes?
Yeah, which is another dimension, because then it's no more covering a justice process, it's covering war crimes themselves, right? So you're now talking about that stage where the journalist's role is different, because it's reporting, it's the initial reporting, it's the first witness to atrocities. I think that, yeah, there is, the clear understanding is that any situation where identifying the person may raise security issues for that person, you have to try to avoid it. You have to use techniques that would protect the whereabouts or the identity of that person. That's kind of basic. And there is a level of free agency of all those people we interview. Like, they are allowed to choose to go public, to be named, but before they choose, they have to make an informed choice. So I think the role of the journalist is always to be extremely clear on what is agreed, what's the agreement, and to have it very clear. It's interesting, though, because in ideal situation, you would even want, but I think it would be horrible, but we could even have like a form ready and we make it signed, and that would amount to an informed agreement. That's not practical, of course, when you're on the front line. And two, I'm not sure that is the solution either, because that doesn't guarantee you that it's informed. It's not because someone signed a paper that is informed. So I think it's just a common sense situation where you have to make sure with a few questions, very genuinely put and listened to, that the person knows what he's agreed or she's agreed on, in terms of being named, identified, the location, etc., etc. That's key. And then, of course, if it's really a very sensitive location, if it's really the front line with risks of being, for instance, captured, the journalist has to have developed also techniques, of course, to hide its own material. And you know, we have our own way to, in such very sensitive situations, which are not very common, but we have our own way to identify the people we interview in a way that someone who gets our notebook or gets our phone or whatever material we use cannot identify the person. There are some. I mean, if you work not in war but in dictatorship, you'd better have that kind of system that only you know, or your editor may know if you think that another source should know, another person should know, but that if in case your material is taken, it won't put at risk the people you've interviewed. So yes, these are the and then, of course, there's the whole question. Sorry, I was just trying to go back to your question. There's the whole question, which I think has been developed a lot now, and that more and more journalists are sensitive to it, know about it, and learn about it, which is how do you interview victims of atrocities? And particularly of sexual violence, if that happens. I think at this point there are a number of pretty good, useful guidelines that have been published over the years on basic things you need to pay attention to when you interview victims, and especially the very specific rules that apply to sexual violence victims and to children, for instance.
Witness.org has done a great job in putting together these resources. So anybody listening to this podcast should definitely be invited to check on those. Let me just broaden the question a little bit before we go towards some final questions that I have. Journalists in these circumstances, as you know, as I know from the Bosnian example, are sometimes the first instance of documenting war crimes. Mm-hmm. And this leads in some future to a possible role of an actor in the trial. There have been raging debates, global debates, on whether journalists should be called upon to testify in war crimes cases. Some journalists opted to do so absolutely willingly, some refused to do so. What would be your advice to Ukrainian journalists in terms of what considerations should they keep in mind regarding this and possible protection of any evidence that they may come across in their reporting for the integrity of some future processes?
Yeah, so it's a tough one, Rafik, because I think it's it has different dimensions. Yes, it's true, the reporter will always be and remain one of the frontliners. It will remain one of these few actors with humanitarian, you know, like Red Cross officials or workers, etc., the first ones to witness a war crime or an atrocity and to collect evidence of it. So that will remain. But now there is a much stronger sense now after the 30 years of transitional justice and international tribunals and war crimes justice. There's a much clearer sense that it may actually become legal evidence. So I don't know, like if you take Ukraine, at least in some places, famous places like Bucha, it's a classic situation where too many people go to the crime scene over the few days after, between NGOs, lawyers, experts, reporters from dozens of media. And it's created a situation where the evidence is diminished because too many people touch it. So that is a problem. And gradually there is an effort to try to make people understand that that what they are dealing with may become crime evidence, and that if everybody manipulates it, then it's going to lose its value in court. I don't know what to do with this, because we can't stop reporters to go to a crime scene. It's hard to stop all these NGOs to document the same thing. I mean, the documentation field has now become a major field of action by NGOs, groups, much more than before. And I'm confused about that situation, Refik, to be honest. I think that there's a sort of paradox between people promoting the use of the need for documenting crimes with the prospect of using it for future trials, and the multitude of these actors collecting the same evidence from the same places and sometimes the same witnesses several times at different occasions, and in that respect actually hurting the whole purpose that they claim to be the purpose of documentation work. So I think we're in a bit of a strange situation. Sometimes there is also, including in these trends, the new trends, it would be to transform reporters into police investigators. No, they're two different jobs. Journalists will never be police investigators. It's not what we do. And so, yes, it's good for reporters to be aware of what a war crime is as much as possible. And so whenever they witness to it, they have a sense of what they need to check and to assess as much as possible in order to know what they are dealing with and to help their own understanding of what they're witnessing, and also to avoid mistakes about naming things wrongly. So that should be a concern for any reporters, to have a better knowledge of, you know, they don't have to become war crimes lawyers, but the more they know about what constitutes a war crime or what is a crime against humanity, the better. I think these days it's part of what their knowledge, the knowledge that they should have, and so they will put the right questions. But there has to be a clear understanding that they remain reporters. They are not here to they're not cops, and they are not doing a criminal investigation at that stage or at any stage, because that's not what we do. We're not trained for that and shouldn't be. We should know more about these crimes because it's become now part of the world we live in. But we're not police investigators, should not be. We have different roles. And that leads me to, if that's okay with you, to the whole issue of should we become witnesses in court and how it's divided the profession. Well, it should divide the profession, and that's totally fine if it does. I think it's a completely individual decision. There is no rule. We are not bound by a particular rule of ethics that would prevent us to do that or force us to do that. So it's up to us, each of us, to decide. As you know very well, because everything about the Yugoslav Court is familiar to you, but of the main jurisprudence came out of the Yugoslav UN tribunal when Jonathan Randall, this reporter from the Washington Post, refused to go and testify. He had interviewed, if I remember well, he had interviewed a guy who became a war crime suspect, and so he was supposed to testify about this. He said, no, it's not my role. You have my material, it's public, it's published. You can use it the way you want. I cannot stop that, but I'm not here to go and do it, because otherwise I cannot do my work anymore. I cannot be a war crimes reporter anymore, because they will always believe that I am actually a court agent. And that's a very strong point. And so that led to the, I think, an amazing jurisprudence. One of the ones that I like the best, because I think it's pretty balanced, it's sensible, it's good, which is to say reporters are not covered by any form of immunity. You know, Red Cross International, ICRC people, International Red Cross agents, do have that kind of immunity, but we don't. And that's totally correct to me. Like, we shouldn't enjoy a particular immunity. But the court said that there should be, we understand what Randall is saying, and there should be an understanding of this, because we need war reporters. And so, for war reporters specifically, only if their evidence is the only one that leads to the guilt or innocence of the suspect, then he would be, complied to come and testify. He won't have a choice. He won't have any protection from testifying in that particular case. I think it's compelled. I think that's a pretty good understanding of what should be. So there is a level of protection from testifying. but then there is also a situation where there is no choice. It's a rare one. And for the rest, it's up to us to decide. What I would say, my experience is that reporters who decide to go and testify should know that they're going to be grilled in a way that is going to most likely show how sloppy we are. And so you have to be aware. I mean, reporters tend to be a bit arrogant about the value of what their material has. Well, when it comes to their legal value in a criminal trial, it's very weak in general. And that's okay, because that's because we're not police investigators. We're not doing this. And so it has value, but it's very challengeable before a court of law. And I think many reporters have been surprised, and not happily surprised, about how their work was exposed in its weaknesses and its lack of value, in a way. So I think anyone who makes a decision should also know that it is not going to, he may not have a heroic moment in court, but a pretty bad one. It's an individual decision. I wouldn't go. I refuse to go. I mean, I was called not for expert testimonies because of the work I do and because of the cases I covered. And I refuse to go because I believe that I cannot be a court reporter anymore if I become part of a trial in the very institutions that I cover. It's a conflict of interest to me, and so I do not want to testify. But again, it's an individual freedom.
Thierry, this has been, I think, a fascinatingly rich discussion with a lot of good material for our Ukrainian colleagues. And last question that I have for you is twofold. One is, what would your message to them be, considering the difference in status, let's say, between an international reporter and a local reporter in these circumstances, a Ukrainian who lives with this war, with this aggression every day and has to do their job on these issues and these cases in these circumstances? And the second aspect of this question, this closing question for our conversation, is the consideration of how long these things take and how do they prepare themselves for years, if not decades, of dealing with this issue, with this topic.
Yeah. Well, on the first part, I mean, I've been working now with a network of Ukrainian reporters covering these war crimes trials or war-related trials, because many of them are about collaboration crimes, before their courts. I'm impressed by the improvement of the quality of their reporting, because, and that's normal, because it takes time before you are a well-equipped court reporter. It takes time. There's a lot of homework that you can't escape, which is to learn the law. You know, again, nobody asks you to become a lawyer, but you need to do your homework. It's a specialized field of work. Just like a scientific reporter needs to understand the way the cosmos works, all these, you know, basic math, algebra or whatever. It's the same for a court reporter. You need to do your homework. You need to understand the law. And you need to understand it to a level where you can say it in normal terms, in simple terms. Because lawyers, of course, have their own way to make it impossible to understand for us. And so, just like scientists. And so our role as reporters is to understand these concepts, the legal concepts, well enough so that we can say it in the language that everybody can understand and still be accurate. That takes time. It's not, you know, within a day that you are equipped in that sense. So I've seen more and more of the reporters we've been working with, they've achieved that. They have that sort of ease now with these legal terms that they can get away with, remove it from their writing so their writing is much clearer and still accurate. I think they've also transformed, to me, I mean, amazingly, when it comes to what we were saying before, like basic principles of protecting the rights of the defendants and protecting the rights of the victims, and always having that balance right, or as right as possible. I think they've done an incredible job in the past 2 years to protect the rights of the defendants to some extent. I mean, honestly, 2 years ago, presumption of innocence was a constant struggle. You need to check every the language. I mean, to learn how to write so that you protect the rights of the defendant, even though you're at war, and even though you are in the middle of that suffering and that unjust invasion and criminal invasion. So that took time too. But I think it's a much different level today. And the third thing that also pleases me is that we now have the kind of reporting that we need to have from reporters, which is their watchdog job. Like, we now publish articles that are strong analysis on the way the courts function. And Without this, I don't think the local courts can keep functioning decently well. And the rule of law in Ukraine that exists can only remain if these reporters do their job, which is to be in court. They're the only ones there sometimes in some of these trials. So to be there and make sure that the process is fair and respecting, you know, basic. And I think they do that. And I think they do that so much better because they're improved, because it's practice. Court reporting is homework and practice. Even homework is not enough. The more you cover trials, the better you're at it. I mean, that's so it takes time. And because they're exposed to so many trials, I think some of them are becoming like real, very good and experienced war crimes trials reporters, you know, and they could be much better. They would be much better than even, you know, well-trained reporters in mainstream media. So, I think their role is twofold, and it's a difficult one because they are citizens of the very country that has been attacked, and you know their families are affected, and so it requires them an incredible level an incredibly strong moral compass to be citizens, Ukrainian citizens, and they are strong ones, and yet understand that they have that role. They have that role of monitoring institutions so that the rule of law remains applicable in their country. Being part, whether they like it or not, they're part of that social cohesion. As I said, many, many of these trials are about collaboration crimes, which can be very divisive in communities. And so if the result of that war is not only destruction, but is also the destruction of the social community, then it's a double injury, right? And so in the way they're going to report on these collaboration trials, it's going to help or not social cohesion in the long run. And I think that gradually people are aware of that too. And it gives them a particular responsibility that is not necessarily, you know, the usual responsibility of a reporter. But in their situation, it is, or it's become. So I think that's the way I see it. Now, are they aware that they're gonna have years and years of these justice processes? Because of course we focused a lot on trials, but there's a lot about the disappeared in Ukraine, which is a major transitional justice issue. There's a lot about reparations that is at stake, and the debate on reparations is complicated and confusing, and yet absolutely central to many people. And so I find them very engaged, the network we work with, and I don't know how aware they are that they might have to do this for years, to be honest. I don't know if maybe it's gonna soon be a situation where they can have that kind of visibility and awareness, but at the moment I think we're all just deep into it. It's war, and there is yet no end, or not certainly no happy end in sight. So I'm not sure, Rafik, that I could even understand that, answer that part. Like, I don't know if there is that awareness of time at this point. Not yet. Maybe soon. Not yet.
Well, let's wish our Ukrainian journalists peace and justice and a lot of strength in the years to come to cover these difficult issues and topics. Thierry, to you, thank you so much for being our guest today. Thierry Crouvelier, Editor-in-Chief of Justice Info. Thank you for coming to Spotlight on Transitional Justice.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. Thank you, Rafiq.